A lot of new pleadings in the Koberger case. One thing is clear, neither the defense or the prosecution want anyone to know what's going on. Murder in America is down. Former President Trump received a target letter. What is a target letter and what should he do? Exonerated after being wrongfully imprisoned for 32 years, now he's going to sue. The suspect of the disappearance of Natalie Holloway is coming to America. Has the city of Portland had enough? Man says that the woman he killed, well, she deserved it. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. He should have been eaten by the bear. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like if you do. Leave me a comment below, and we got a lot to talk about today. And hit that little bell for notifications. And remember, you can listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Now, we got to pay the bills. So go to crimetalksearch.com. Sign up for that background subscription service today. You'll be happy you did. Take a look at this unsolicited comment that we received. A lady who said, oh, I wasn't too sure about this, but guess what? I was looking to have somebody do some work for me, went to crimetalksearch.com, signed up for that background search, and found out that the person that, well, they were going to hire, come into their life, had an extensive criminal history. Take my word for it, ladies and gentlemen. You need to check people out if they're coming into your lives. Get that background search. Find out what kind of criminal history they have. Find out if they're on a public registry. Who knows? It could save your life. Go to crimetalksearch.com. You'll be happy you did. Let's go ahead and open the record for June 8th, 2023, and let's begin with the docket. A lot of new filings in the Brian Koberger matter, and one thing is clear. Neither the prosecution nor the defense want us to know anything about what is going on in the courtroom. Let me explain. First, the defense has filed a brief, their objection to the media's motion to vacate the non-dissemination order. And basically what they're saying is that the non-dissemination order does not violate the First Amendment. And as you know, the family members of several of the victims want to be able to talk about what they know about the case. And they basically have been told they can't do that, because there's a non-dissemination order. And since they're victims' family members, they can't talk about the case. So the attorneys for Koberger said that the Idaho Supreme Court agreed with Mr. Koberger on the writ of mandamus, or writ of prohibition, that was filed with the Idaho Supreme Court. And the Idaho Supreme Court agreed with Mr. Koberger that the media had failed to show the absence of an adequate, plain, or speedy remedy in the ordinary course of law. And the Idaho Supreme Court also agreed with the media that it had standing, something that Mr. Koberger never disputed. And while the ruling on the standing issue, the court found that the vague, overly broad, unduly restrictive, or not narrowly drawn non-dissemination order would be unconstitutional. The court then found that the order states that it includes, but is not limited to, attorneys and their agents, possibly applying to a broad swath of the population. So, Koberger's attorney said, then armed with this language, the media returned to court on May 1st, triumphant, complaining the Supreme Court agreed that unconstitutional orders are unconstitutional, and that all is left is the court to follow its lead. However, Mr. Koberger says things are not that simple. The state then superseded the indictment in this particular case, and it specifically to epitomize the concerns of Mr. Koberger that the state and this court, NBC Dateline, released another special on the case. Koberger complains that the media is using their playbook, and they've chosen throughout this case the special that NBC ran details investigations, facts that are wrong. Despite access to the arrest affidavit, it chooses to treat Mr. Koberger as already guilty, asking multiple experts to speculate as to how and why he committed the murders without once asking if the police had the right person. And it provides audience with made-up evidence of Mr. Koberger's character that will never see the inside of a courtroom. It even had a leak just a little over 2 weeks after the media claimed there were none. And the upshot of this, similar media stories, is a constant feedback loop of people crying out for Mr. Koberger's blood. One of those that now leads the pack happens to be a lawyer who has inserted himself in this case, Mr. Gray, who, despite the order not to communicate to the media, can be seen going over and over again ever since the indictment occurred. More recently, then the media filed an additional memorandum in support of its motion, as well as eight declarations of various reporters previously contained in counsel for the media's own declaration, apparently to illustrate the dangers of hearsay. According to Media News Memorandum, this court should not accept an ambush of evidence from the actual parties in the case because we had our chance back when both agreed to the non-dissemination order. So that's the crux of the argument. The defense does not want anyone to have any information about this particular case whatsoever. But as I have stated in the past, what the defense does by not allowing facts to come into the case is then you get speculation. Now, in another motion, the defense complains about all the body language experts speculating on what it really means. And, well, I'm going to have to agree with the defense on that. I'm not a big body language person. Yeah, there's some people that cross their legs, cross their arms, but somebody sitting there, saying, oh, they didn't blink, they didn't do this, they must be guilty. Garbage, garbage, garbage. Don't buy it for a second. So I get where the defense is coming from, but we should have people to be able to talk about the facts. And guess what? Although the defense doesn't have to prove themselves innocent, right? The burden is always on the prosecution. The defense can use the media machine just as much as the prosecution can, as long as it's factually driven. And if you have information that it is the wrong suspect in this particular case, then guess what? Wouldn't that help your case? Wouldn't the large dissemination of that evidence help the defense possibly raise reasonable doubt? Well, we continue. There's a motion filed regarding the memorandum of cameras in the courtroom. And needless to say, the defense does not want cameras in the courtroom. Specifically, given the sensational nature of this case, the audiovisual coverage has become material for news outlets and social media accounts to espouse their unfounded opinions. Following each of Mr. Koberger's court appearances, numerous social media posts have been made regarding him throughout Facebook posts, YouTube and TikTok videos, and a podcast. Each video attempts to analyze Mr. Koberger's demeanor by observing his body language from the court appearances and describing him uses phrases such as cold iciness. It looks like it's just filled with darkness and hate, and he keeps getting creepier among other phases. These are people's opinions. Yes, I get it, but you can't prohibit that one way or the other. And the defense acknowledges that while the media holds the crucial role of informing the public of criminal proceedings, the right only exists to the extent that it does not impede upon the rights of the defendant, in this case, Mr. Koberger, and is subject to maintaining fairness in the judicial process. A fundamental right of every defendant is the right to a fair trial by an impartial jury established by the Sixth Amendment of the United States, which reads, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusations, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. I love the Sixth Amendment. I really do. Anyway, the defense says the right to a public trial is not a right belonging to the public, but one belonging to the accused. And they cite some 1965 Supreme Court case law stating that as such, even though a public may have an interest in a particular case, interest alone does not create a constitutional right. Now, I've heard arguments about this. Usually when it comes to speedy trial, when the defense wants to delay, the prosecutors will often argue and say that, well, the people of the state or the district and where they are in have just as much right to have this case resolved as the defendant in a timely manner. So I tend to disagree with the defense. I think the public does have a right to know. Yes, they don't get a copy of the discovery in this case, but they should be allowed to see what goes on in a courtroom. This is 2023. We have ways of videotaping what takes place in a courtroom. It can be focused on the judge and the counsel at the podium, or even just the judge. The reality of it is, it's 2023. And yes, people want to know. And when people don't get facts, that's where all the wackadoos come out and start speculating big time. The defense then also says that when cameras are present in the courtroom, the defendant becomes subject to minute scrutiny as his or her every movement can be replayed and analyzed. In the present case, Mr. Koberger's actions are heavily scrutinized as self-proclaimed experts utilize audio-video footage from courtroom proceedings to make assumptions regarding his body language and character, which actualizes prior court's concerns regarding the presence of a camera in the courtroom. For instance, a YouTube video titled "Psychologist Breaks Down Brian Koberger's Arraignment Body Language" purports to dissect every gesture, even shift in posture, every flicker of emotion that crossed Koberger's face during the tense courtroom scene, while utilizing only one courtroom video. And then the defense says, hey, like that Vallow trial, the purpose of the footage is to scrutinize Mr. Koberger's actions. And in the Vallow trial, the court determined that the footage during a hearing demonstrated an inordinate focus on the defendant. Here, the court need not determine the purpose of the video utilizing audiovisual recordings, as the purpose of the commentator's purpose is explicitly clear. As such, a video would not exist except for the presence of the cameras in the courtroom. And the video posted on May 23rd garnered over 44,000 views in 2 days, further demonstrating the high-level interest in this case and the potential impact of pretrial publicity. They go on to say that even the New York Post relied upon audio-visual recordings to analyze Mr. Koberger's body language. The article states that by dissecting his most minute behavior, from the use of his tongue to his controlled reaction and tone of voice, can paint a picture of his mindset. By doing so, the recordings are once again being utilized to scrutinize Mr. Koberger as the, quote, expert, end quote, reached an uncorroborated conclusion after viewing only one video. Kind of got to agree with the defense on that. But hey, people are going to do what they're going to do with that. Every defense attorney knows when you go to court, you want your client to look good. You know that everything is going to be scrutinized. You know that the jury is going to be looking at him. Even the jury of the public is going to be looking at him. The jury of the public opinion is going to be looking at the defendant. So you better prepare your defendant. Remember, I mean, look at John Pryor. He always has his client, Chad Daybell, show up in a shirt, not jailhouse garb. Has him dressed in a shirt and a tie. He's trying to give that image that his client is a good guy. It's something the defense always has to deal with. And whether one person from the news media is in the courtroom describing what is taking place, or we're getting to see it for ourselves, at least we're getting to see it. Now, of course, the prosecution. I know some people say, oh, Scott, you're so pro-defense. I don't think so. I'm against the defense on this particular issue. But what does the prosecution do? Well, in the non-dissemination order, they're basically like, well, we'll just do whatever you want us to do, Judge. Don't worry about us. And then as it relates to the video in the courtroom, they're all wishy-washy and like, well, we understand the public's right to know, but hey, here's the order in the Vallow case, Judge. Why don't you go ahead and follow that? Typical politician trying to play both sides. Well, if the court's going to grant it, we can probably work something out, but we don't want it because, you know, it's going to put pressure on us to do our jobs and to see if we got it right. And we really don't want that now, do we? So typical government stuff. A lot of stuff. I'll take even a closer look at it, but it all hit today, even though it was filed on June 6th. Once again, the court letting us get our hands on it when, well, they think it's appropriate. All right, finally some good news as it relates to crime. Apparently, homicides in some of the largest states and cities in America are falling after 2 years of soaring numbers during the pandemic. So far this year, killings are down 12%. But don't worry, we still got 6 months to go. Overall, in 9 of the most 10 popular cities, compared with the same time frame last year, according to local government data. Now, homicides are down in six of those cities, including 27% in Los Angeles, 22% in Houston, 16% in Philadelphia, and in Texas, the cities of Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, unfortunately, they're in a little bit of an uptick. Now, some criminologists suggest that conditions that drove the violence up in 2020 and 2021, particularly a rise in domestic disputes and a pause in gang violence prevention programs during the pandemic, as well as pullback in police enforcement after, well, you know, the whole George Floyd stuff. So last year, the number of killings dropped 5% in 70 of the largest U.S. cities from 2021. And the Police Chiefs Association basically says that, you know, we're hoping things get a little bit better. Philadelphia reported a record 562 homicides in 2021. And that is believed to be due to the closing of courts and schools during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the wave of protests calling to defund the police department, obviously impacting policing and what the police are supposed to be doing. The police chief spokesman says the narrative was to defund and abolish, which undermined the police credibility and authority. At least things are getting a little better. We'll wait and see. We still have 6 months left in the year to go. Now, it's been reported that former President Trump received a target letter. What is a target letter? Well, let me tell you, you don't want to receive a target letter. When the United States Attorney's Office sends a letter to either you or your attorney saying you're a target, that means they're investigating you. It means they're coming for you. And it's simply a letter from the federal government telling you you are a criminal prosecution target. And it's frequently used in white-collar crimes and is typically the first sign that you are under investigation. A target can be defined as someone where the government believes there is substantial evidence of crime. The target letter notifies you of the crime that you are suspected of committing, your right to assert your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and information for obtaining a court-appointed lawyer if you cannot afford one. And the letter will also caution you of, don't destroy any evidence, which could result in additional charges like obstruction of justice. The letter may even ask that you contact a prosecutor on the case to discuss the case further and your possible appearance before a grand jury. This is why you need to get a lawyer, even if you're the former president of the United States. They're hinting to you. They're telling you. You have a right to remain silent. They're warning you. We're coming for you. You get a lawyer, you lawyer up. Yes, getting a lawyer does not make you look guilty. You're allowed to have one. And it's better to look guilty, even if you think that, than to be found guilty. Now, once you get a target letter, does that mean you're actually going to be indicted? Yeah, no. However, I can't personally think of a situation where I've had a client receive a target letter and, well, they haven't been indicted. So it's pretty high, but obviously it's not inevitable. Prosecutors are maybe not always able to gather sufficient evidence to indict their targets. In some cases, attorneys may be able to persuade the prosecutors to close the investigation or to reclassify the target as maybe just a mere witness. Now, whether this depends on the facts of the applicable case. Like I said, the target letter is an advisement to you to shut your mouth. It's kind of like, you know, when they advise you of your Miranda rights, they're telling you, hey, you shouldn't say anything. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more, right? But people do it all the time. Just saying. Like I said, in my experience, you get a target letter, they're coming for you. Get a lawyer, lawyer up. Every time we've got to that point, it's usually because the prosecutors just basically, they're straight shooters. They're good guys. I've had other people say, hey, we're just going to indict your client. Okay, where was the target letter? Oh, they don't have to send a target letter. It's just kind of their way of saying, we're coming for you, and this is your opportunity to try to help before we indict you. So we'll see if the former president is indicted and if there, maybe we'll actually get to see a target letter if that is the case. Next on the docket, a man exonerated after being wrongfully imprisoned for 32 years. Well, they want to sue. So Joaquin Ciria, C-I-R-I-A, spent much of his life behind bars after being charged with first-degree murder back in 1990 when he was 29 years old. He was officially exonerated of the shooting death of his friend Felix Bastarrica in San Francisco Superior Court last April after serving 32 years in prison. Well, he was 61 when he was released. Now, in a lawsuit filed yesterday in federal court, the Syria family now demands that the city pay for his wrongful detention for more than 3 decades and face a jury trial. Now, Syria's case was taken up by the Northern California Innocence Project back in 2020, which said that police relied upon rumors to target him and coerced another man who drove the actual shooter to name Syria as the gunman falsely. The project said, although the driver, George Varela, told police that Syria was innocent, police told Varela he could either implicate Syria or be charged himself. Syria never confessed to the crime and always maintained his innocence. And the Varela's sister and family friend both said Varela told them Syria was innocent. So an eyewitness in prison for an unrelated crime came forward in 2020 to say he saw another man, Candido Diaz, argue with Bastarica at the scene before the shots were fired. The eyewitness said that Diaz left the scene in Varela's car. Now, the Innocence Commission, a volunteer team of legal and medical experts formed in 2020 by the former San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, helped lead the successful effort to clear Syria's name, ultimately winning his exoneration. Now, Syria's son, Pedro, and former partner, Johanna Paez, said that Syria's conviction was the direct result of the city and police department's unconstitutional investigative policies and a failure to train or intervene to prevent constitutional violations. They allege that the city failed to implement remedial measures to address tainted, reckless, and unconstitutional investigations and interrogation techniques. The lawsuit states that at least 5 black men were falsely convicted of murders between 1990 and 1991 in San Francisco based upon fabricated evidence, unconstitutionally influenced witnesses' identification, or improperly incentivized evidence from the San Francisco Police Department officers and inspectors. They also allege it was a pattern of tactics used by the city during the 1980s and 1990, leading to unjustified convictions of people of color. The plaintiffs also allege that the police maintained a practice of manufacturing unreliable suspect identifications, including repeatedly suggesting that witnesses make less than certain identifications, selectively recording portions of the interviews, falsely documenting witnesses' identifications, and priming witnesses to identify specific suspects. You mean that goes on? Oh my goodness. Now, today, most things are videotaped, and, well, you see a lot of these allegations disappear because it's all videotaped. But when it wasn't, ladies and gentlemen, bad things happened. The pleadings detail the way the inspectors handling the original case prepared Varela to testify against Syria. Plaintiffs allege that the inspectors threatened Varela with a murder charge if he didn't fall into line and coerced Varela into adopting their narrative. They also repeatedly influenced unreliable witnesses' identifications to implicate Syria further, relying on unreliable descriptions of the killer that did not match him. Varela received multiple benefits, included repeated leniency from the district attorney's office in exchange for his testimony. The plaintiffs say that on at least 3 occasions in 1990, Varela signed promises to appear relating to court dates and probation requirements that he did not keep. The improper coercive conduct of the detectives is the only reason Varela implicated Syria, and the inspectors had good reason to know Syria was innocent, they allege in their complaint. The inspectors did not just fabricate a story designed to pin Bastarica's murder on Syria. They ignored reliable, consistent evidence demonstrating Syria's innocence throughout their investigation in favor of their false plan. Syria's attempt to assist the inspectors were met with unjustified, malicious reprisal that would rob Syria of more than half of his life in prison. The demand for money includes losing contact with Syria for decades due to the wrongful imprisonment and claiming that the county inflicted intentional and neglectful emotional distress by doing so. What do you do? What do you do? I mean, they have a tough road here, but the man was exonerated after 32 years. Somebody's got to pay. I'm assuming the detectives that worked the case are probably dead or really old. But either way, if they can prove that they lied, well, they should go to prison. well, for the rest of their lives. We'll try to watch that case as things go on. Next, the suspect for the disappearance of Natalie Holloway is coming to America. Just want to play that song, Coming to America, but not for this particular reason, right? So that's right. The main suspect in the 2005 disappearance of the student, Natalie Holloway, was handed over to U.S. custody and departed Peru on a flight to the United States on Thursday, roughly a month after both countries agreed to his extradition. Joran Vandersloot is wanted in the U.S. and one count each of extortion and wire fraud, only charges to have ever been linked the Dutch citizen to Holloway's disappearance on the Caribbean island of Aruba. Now, Tuesday, his extradition moved forward after a Peruvian judge affirmed the decision to temporarily transfer custody to U.S. authorities. Vandersloot is serving a 28-year prison sentence for the murder of a Peruvian woman, and authorities over the weekend moved him from a maximum security prison in the Andes to the detention facility in Lima. It's not exactly clear when he would make his first court appearance in the United States, and the United States U.S. Attorney's Office declined to comment on Vandersloot's departure from Peru. Now, Holloway, who lived in suburban Birmingham, Alabama, was only 18 when she vanished during the trip with classmates to Aruba, and she was last seen leaving a bar with Vandersloot, who was a student at the international school on the island. Vandersloot was identified as a suspect and detained weeks later, along with two brothers. Now, Holloway's body was never found and no charges were filed in the case, and a judge later declared Holloway was dead. Now, federal charges filed in Alabama against Vandersloot stem from the accusation that he tried to extort the Holloway's family in 2010, promising to lead them to her body in exchange for hundreds of thousands of dollars. The grand jury indicted Vandersloot that year on one count each of wire fraud and extortion. Now, in 2012, Vandersloot pled guilty in Peru to murdering 21-year-old Stephanie Flores, a business student from a prominent Peruvian family. Like I said, she was killed in 2020, 5 years to the day after Holloway's disappearance. Now, a 2001 treaty between Peru and the United States allows a suspect to be temporarily extradited to face trial in the other country. Vandersloot's attorney, Maximo Altez, initially indicated his client would not challenge the extradition, but then changed his mind Monday when he filed a writ of habeas corpus. A judge ruled against Vandersloot the following day, and the time that Vandersloot ends up spending in the United States will be extended until the conclusion of the criminal proceedings here in the United States, including the appeal process, should there be one. The resolution also states that the United States authorities agree to return Vandersloot to the custody of Peru after the matters are resolved. Now, Vandersloot married a Peruvian woman in 2014 in a ceremony at a maximum security prison. He was transferred among Peruvian prisoners in response to reports that he enjoyed privileges such as television, internet access, and cell phones, and accusations that he threatened to kill a warden. Nice guy. Nice guy. And who threatens the family to tell where the location is unless you know where the body is? Probably a case that will never be solved in a court of law. Next, has the city of Portland had enough? That's right. Well, even in Portland, people get tired of nonsense. The Portland City Council voted Wednesday to pass an ordinance prohibiting camping during daytime hours in most public places. And like other places in the United States, they are struggling to address a homelessness crisis, I should say. That's right. You know, because like here, it's unconstitutional to have a camping ban in Colorado. A county court judge said it was unconstitutional to have a camping ban. Therefore, we have people camping everywhere on the streets. And yes, there's no crime against being poor or being homeless, but it is a health and safety concern when people are living in human feces and there's no running water. That's why we have those bans, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, the city council voted 3-1 to change the city code to say that people may camp in non-restricted areas from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., but after that, they must dismantle the site until the permitted overnight hours begin once again. The ordinance also bans camping entirely near schools, parks, and busy streets, among other locations. And it was, guess what? Business and property owners were among those who backed the ordinance, saying that campsites are causing them to lose customers and creating safety issues. Of course, the advocates for the homeless said it will further burden them, heighten mental and physical distress throughout the day. Now, Portland has already prohibited camping on city property at all hours, but that measure was rarely been enforced and could be found to violate state law that went into effect on July 1st. The Portland ban, we'll see how that works. But even the most progressive city council apparently gets tired of a little shanty town in front of their homes, businesses, schools. Oh, and becomes it's not safe because it becomes a haven for drugs. Tell me I'm wrong. Okay? And if you are, let's go take a stroll down downtown streets. Next, a man who killed a woman says she deserved it. So an Indiana guy out on bail and wearing a GPS ankle monitor for stabbing a customer at a Circle K convenience store pled guilty to fatally stabbing his ex-girlfriend not once, not twice, but 51 times. Why, you may ask? Well, because she made fun of him in text with a man she was sleeping with. Now, who is this wonderful human being? This guy, Marcus Garvin. That's right, he pled guilty days before his jury trial was set to begin as it relates to one count of murder in the death of Christy Holt. He was sentenced to 45 years in prison. Seems like a pretty lenient sentence in light of what he did. Garvin confessed to stabbing Holt the day after he went through her cell phone and discovered texts between her and a man that she was engaged in a relationship with. In the texts, the two had been making fun of Garvin for not having a job and not going anywhere in life. Ha! He'll show them, right? That's right, he told the detectives that after his arrest. Now, Mr. Garvin woke Holt up and confronted her with what he had discovered, and of course she denied it. That made him even more upset, according to the arrest affidavit. As Holt fought for her life, Garvin stabbed her numerous times in the neck and upper body, according to the affidavit, and he thought that maybe he stabbed her at least 10, maybe 15 times at the most. But the autopsy found 51 stab wounds to the head, neck, and chest and thighs. She had defensive wounds on her hands. Now, Mr. Garvin, being the gentleman that he is, told investigators, it took about 30 minutes for her to die. Following the attack, Garvin spent the next 6 days trying to figure out how to dispose of the remains, according to the affidavit. And after he killed her, he told police he didn't know really what to do. First, he dragged her body to the bathtub and turned the shower on, hoping to keep the smell down. Then he tried to dismember the body in the bathtub using a small sickle knife, but couldn't cut through the bone. Then Mr. Garvin also tried to move the body with a grocery cart, but couldn't get the body into it. Garvin even brought home a dolly from work, but still couldn't move her body, so he placed Holt in a motel sheet and comforter and dragged it across the parking lot to a creek. The motel desk clerk spotted him and called the police, reporting a suspicious person pulling a sheet with something heavy near the wooded area next to the motel in the morning. Just saying, I think that 45 years was a gift to Mr. Garvin. Not sure what the prosecutors were thinking in that particular case, but maybe they figure he'll never get out of prison anyway. And finally today, our dumb criminal of the day. That's right, the bear should have eaten him. So Yellowstone park rangers are on the hunt for this tourist who his video was going viral for the wrong reasons. The social media clip shows him hopping out of his car and charging at a bear at least twice and then grunting, growling, and barking at the bear. Well, he could find himself in jail, and it's all because of some videos of him running up to the bear, which they say is against the law, shockingly. That's right. He could be charged with disturbing wildlife, disorderly conduct, and approaching wildlife, all a crime. As you can see from the footage posted on an Instagram account dedicated to shaming Yellowstone tourists, the bear books it away from the tourist running off into the woods. The man then turns back to the cameras, ripping off his shirt and flexing. That's because the bear is smarter than you are. You know what the bear said? What we say here all the time. Let it go, right? Because if the bear takes off the man's head, the bear gets euthanized. So he's a smart bear. The man, not so smart. Anyway, officials say they're investigating the incident, and the man, if found and prosecuted, could be fined $5,000 and thrown into jail for up to 16 months. Like I said, bear, let it go. Smart bear. Man, stupid. All right, that's all we have for you today. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.